This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Matt Pegas. He has his premiere novel out, his very first, published by Matt Forney's Terror House Press. It's called Dragon Day. Matt Pegas, great speaking with you about your first novel.
Yeah, good to be here. I'm obviously a regular co-host on your show, and we've done our own podcast in the past focused on my work, but this is definitely the most significant probably podcast we've done about a work of mine. So, glad to be on as usual, but especially now with the novel as the focal point.
So, yeah, before we dive into the book, I want to kind of revisit some of the personal stuff and kind of the introductions. The very first show that we did a couple years ago, kind of give an introduction to yourself. So, yeah. The book is influenced by your personal experience in college, and it takes place in 2015, so the terminology, SJW, it may sound dated, but that's when it takes place. So how much of this is based on your personal experience, and if you mind me asking, is any of this semi-autobiographical?
Yeah, I think that's a good place to start. I mean, it's set in 2015, which was a very purposeful choice. That time setting seemed to me not only is it the time period that I was actually in college, so there are autobiographical elements which I'll get into, but also just I think a very fruitful time in recent history in the United States and in the political scene. It was the time right before Trump. Trump was just starting to be kind of become a household name, as a Republican nominee, but it was before the time that people actually knew he'd be the nominee, so I wouldn't have to deal explicitly with Trump in the novel.
No, so you never actually mention the word Trump, but you do mention, I don't know if the word was woke was used that frequently. You do mention the words SJW and alt-right.
Yes. Okay, a couple things to unpack there. I mean, actually, the word Trump is used once.
Oh, okay.
But it's okay, I'm not correcting you.
Yeah, I read the rough draft and you sent it to me, but with the physical copy of the novel, I'm 60% of the way through.
Yeah, no worries. Let me just say, this isn't to correct you in some mogging sort of way, but just rather because I think it was an interesting and purposeful choice. The word Trump is used once, and it's in the parade, the Dragon Day parade at the end of the novel, which feature, you have to read the novel to figure out what the Dragon Day parade is, but basically it involves people sort of dressing up as figures from popular culture. And one of those figures, along with, I think I put him next to Vladimir Putin and Kim Jong-un and I believe Hillary Clinton, one of those figures is Trump. But he's not referenced as the Republican nominee. He's just referenced one.
Vaguely as a symbol.
One of several celebrities.
Oh, yeah, I think I may remember that. Yeah, with one of the floats for the parade.
Yeah, not to unpack my own writing in some gay way, but I would say that's supposed to be a little bit of foreshadowing, a little bit of a wink, wink, nudge, nudge, this guy will be pretty relevant. But it was, the novel, that scene in the novel and the novel in general takes place in the spring of 2015. So it was right around the time Trump would have been announcing his candidacy. But yes, it doesn't deal with Trump as a figure. It does mention the word SJW, I think, once, although it's not put in one of my own characters' mouths. I believe it's maybe in a news report or some such thing. It's just kind of something in the water. And I do use the term alt-right once, which, if I'm being honest, maybe that was jumping the gun a little bit, because I don't know how many people besides the actual online community actually would have known that word. in 2015. But that the word alt-right is used, I think, only once or twice.
It existed with Richard Spencer, but it didn't become a household name until the 2016 election.
Until Hillary Clinton said it in 2016.
Oh, right.
Or that. But I'll give myself I don't think I jumped the gun too much, because the context I use that term in is a character very explicitly going down some of these online rabbit holes. So I guess it would have been conceivable that he could have come across it. But to get back to your original question, set in 2015 purposefully, I would say in the calm before the storm of Trump rising to prominence, and at a time when I remember it this way, and being in college I remember it this way, the cultural left, we now call SJWs or woke, all of these are overused terms, but I don't know how else to describe it. At that time, they were kind of having a field day. The first really big summer of BLM was basically 2015. So I remember it as a time when those progressive forces seemed really to be forces to be reckoned with, and had a lot of cultural power and fancied themselves sort of unopposed. We're taking over. That was the sensibility. And certainly on college campus, that's what it felt like. However, even at that time, I wasn't that invested in any dissident online communities or anything, but there was a sense that there kind of was a pushback brewing on its own terms, sort of under the surface, and that was gaining power. That feeling was in the air, and then sure enough, in 2016, it came to light when it aligned itself with the Trump movement. Basically, this is set in 2015 because I think it's a fruitful setting of two opposing political forces that had not yet quite met in the middle and led to the current stage of the culture war, which we're still enmeshed in. These two sides were kind of on their own sides of the fence, and both seemed to be gaining power, is the way I remember it.
So, revisiting, the very first show we did, it's important to point out that you've never been... So we talk about your political evolution. You have actually never been on the far right or the far left. You'd say you transitioned from a normie centrist who voted for Hillary Clinton when you were in college to more dissident centrism. So you took one version of centrism to the other, but you've never been on the far right or far left. Do you want to kind of explain your political evolution?
Sure. Yeah, and I wrote what I called an addendum to Dragon Day, which goes into this a little bit on my Substack. I think that you described it pretty well. In college, I was sort of in the neighborhood of a center-left, sort of vaguely neocon. I hesitate to use some of these labels. I don't want to make myself look too bad, because really what I was at the time was I was just very naive, and I was brought up Catholic, and I had a certain amount of conservative a certain degree of a conservative worldview, and yet I was trying to fit in on a very progressive, very elitist campus. And I think that's kind of where my politics came from, was as a lot of people's politics do, I think, even once they get more intellectual about it. I was trying to smooth over contradictions with myself and, trying to say, well, I have these views, I have a certain degree of conservatism, but I want to, make that work with the views of people around me, that kind of thing. Which I think is actually an interesting case study. I mean, I don't want to overstate it, but I think that is kind of, in some ways, I think it's a similar personality to a lot of people who are neocons, whether in the...
So yeah, the character Charles, he seems to be kind of a neocon. He doesn't like woke culture SJWs, but he hates the alt-right too. So he's kind of, he seems a neocon type who would have been like a Romney to Clinton voter. I'm not sure.
Maybe.
I'm not sure if you compare him, if he's more like that type, like a never-Trumper, or if he's close to that, but was that character Charles based on yourself to a degree, or they both were, both Toby and Charles?
Well, they certainly both were to different degrees. I mean, I don't know if Charles would have been a Romney to Clinton voter per se.
Yeah, he's vague about his own views, but you get the impression that he's against fascism or racism, but he's also against political correctness, like the kind of people who want to, maybe you're a bit like the intellectual, even a lot of the intellectual dark web types.
I think so.
Who want to kind of freeze things in like the colorblind classical liberalism of the late 20th century. That's basically what Charles's character, that's the Charles character. And it's from different, it's a multiple narrator book. There's like two or three different narrators in the book.
Yeah, I mean, there's really only one narrator, but I'll get to that in a second. I mean, I wouldn't shoehorn Charles quite into that, nor would I certainly not shoehorn myself into those views. I think that, but I can understand what you're saying. I think he does come out sounding a bit like that because it's less that he has like a positive political agenda, or less even that I have a positive political agenda that I'm trying to push in the book. It's more that you're seeing someone that's kind of transitioning between two views, and that can come out as a little bit IDW or even neocon-ish, because I think that's what a lot of people have gone through over the past 5 or 10 years in the more normie sphere, so to speak, is this sense of, okay, well, I'm not a liberal anymore. You know, a lot of people move from, just being Obama voters, and kind of taking it for granted that the liberal democratic side is basically, the way to go. They move away from that when they get disgusted with, the excesses of progressivism, and certainly on campus that happens a lot and happened to me, seeing the protests, and you kind of realize, oh, I'm not on board with all this. But then what you move to right from there, I mean, not everyone is going to immediately be meaningfully based, so to speak. You may go through different cycles of like, oh, maybe I'm a little bit center right, or maybe I'm a libertarian. Maybe the IDW is right. Maybe I would like, maybe I just wish it was the 90s again. I think people go through these phases of perception.
And yeah, also because it's based on the character's inner dialect, you get a deeper understanding than what people say. It's based on the inner dialogue.
For sure, yeah. It's not... The novel is a political novel. But I don't want to make it sound like, oh, this is a pro-IDW novel or a pro-neocon novel. I think it's more just, in my mind, reflecting my own experience to an extent, and also I think reflecting a lot of people's experience of, once you sort of switch sides or once you move away from just being like a normie liberal, you're not going to immediately be, super based about everything. It takes some time to transition away, and I think that's what's captured in the Charles character and his perception, and he later meets someone who influences his views in that direction, and that's basically what I went through to an extent in the years immediately following college.
So you have this addendum to Dragon Day on Substack, and you talk a lot about the like Straussian dialects on German nihilism and the dangers of the progressive education and dialectical thinking, which, Straussianism, it's sort of, sometimes it's linked to like the philosophical origins behind the neocons and like the Claremont Institute, but at the same time, like both fascist and leftist are interested in the same dialectical reading. What is the significance? Can you kind of explain to those who've never heard it, who've not unfamiliar with the concept of the Straussian dialect, explain what that is and the significance to the themes in the book.
Yeah, there's a, how to put this, again, not that the novel's explicitly Straussian, but I found it to be one interesting avenue of sort of interpretation of some of what happens in the book. There's a famous, not just Leo Strauss, but one of his students, Alan Bloom, wrote a section of his famous book, The Closing of the American Mind, called The German Connection, where Bloom essentially describes all the sort of German, the underpinnings in a lot of German philosophy, from Nietzsche to Heidegger to Max Weber, and a lot of sort of relativistic thinkers. Bloom makes the case that these these same mostly Germanic philosophers of the early 20th century underlie the modern progressive leftist project that underlied, you know, fascism and Nazism. And not to explicitly co-sign on the view that Bloom presents in that essay, but in my own experience in college with sort of postmodern thought, I did find there to be some, at least, you know, I'm not a full-on neocon on
this. Oh, yeah, but at least one thing that's kind of interesting is there is kind of a confusion about what defines a neocon, because they're, like, I grew up in the Bush era as a teenager. That was my political awakening. And they're seen as a pretty easy group to hate. But the thing is, like, there is confusion, because there's one idea that, like, George Bush was a radical liberal who wanted to spread mass democracy. Then there's another interpretation where the neocons actually had a philosophical basis that was extremely hierarchical and actually right-wing, as opposed to many paleocons would say that neocons were actually, neoconservatism was just like hawkish radical liberalism. So I've heard those two different interpretations, but I'm not sure how relevant that is to the book.
Yeah, maybe not. It's definitely an interesting topic. I'm not sure how explicitly relevant it is to the book.
Yeah, probably Paul Gottfried might be the best person to ask.
Yeah, no, and I referenced Paul Gottfried in that addendum as well. I mean, there's a whole history there that's interesting to delve into. But in terms of the German connection, I just, in my own studies, have found there to be sort of interesting tidbits of connection, and even just an irony, which is worth reflecting upon. The fact that, for example, postmodern thinkers like Jacques Derrida, are almost rooted almost entirely in Heidegger, and the Heideggerian notion of, Derrida's deconstruction rooted in, basically the Heideggerian take of a second beginning. I'm not the most eloquent speaker.
Isn't Heidegger referenced in the book?
Heidegger and Nietzsche both are referenced in the book. In large part, the book is a satire, maybe satire is too strong a word, but it definitely satirizes a lot of postmodern thought and strange, very insular academic communities that are deeply engaged in postmodern thought. That is satirized in the book in the character of the professor. And in terms of the German connection of it all, without sounding like a neocon, without saying, leftists are the real fascists because Heidegger, that's not my point. But that being said, I think there is a reality worth reflecting upon, that the intellectual heritage and the obsession with dialectics, which goes actually before some of the more explicitly fascist German thinkers and back to Hegel, some of that those philosophical similarities are fun to play with. And in the book, what you have is a professor who is exoterically very progressive, like one of these postmodern thinkers who uses, Derrida and crew to bolster quote unquote woke ends. That's what he is exoterically. But esoterically, he has a sort of fascist outlook, which he conveys to the protagonist, Toby. And so that's where the German connection comes in. It was the idea not of finger wagging like, oh, you leftists are really racist or something. Nothing like that. However, the idea of someone very explicitly saying these strange schools of thought that are prevalent on college campuses and that are used to underlie progressive activism can actually be rooted back to something which could be utilized to fascistic ends.
And then there's the kind of incel angle, or just the archetype or trope of the alienated young male, and it's a theme, you talked to Andy Nowicki, a theme in his work, and like the book The Columbine Pilgrim, which I've read a long time ago, and then similarities to the gnome character in my book Journey to Vapor Island, in the new book, which is a sequel to that. So is a lot of that, like, you never really identified as an incel, but is some of that shaped by like adolescent trauma or experiences, any like traumatic experience you had in college?
I can't pinpoint it to any explicit experience, thankfully. I mean, you asked at the beginning of the show, and other people have asked to what extent this novel autobiographical. And I'll just say, because this is explicitly out there, and it's in the excerpt that I posted, you know, to Terror House last year, the novel does begin with a rape. And thankfully, that is not autobiographical, and no equivalent trauma has befallen me.
What about the one where Toby was kicked out of the party? Or he was not let in?
Sure. Things like that have definitely happened to me. I mean, I talked a little bit about this with Andy Nowicki, as you highlighted. I think it's just, I don't think one needs to be an incel or a quote-unquote true cell, you know, someone who's really, really identified with that community or really had long-standing trauma of that nature. One doesn't need to be fully that to, you know, have experience of being a guy, being a male, and, you know, realizing your place in the pecking order in a way which can often be unflattering. That's happened to me, you know, in high school and college. And, yeah, I don't want to overstate it like I'm some low-status male and this novel's my revenge upon the world. I mean, it doesn't really feel that way, but I think that most guys, except for, I guess, natural giga-chads, can relate to that kind of thing. And it's definitely was, I'll even put it positively, it was an inspiration an early inspiration for the novel of the sense of inferiority and the sort of beta male rage, I guess, that I may have experienced, and kind of trying to detect where that rage, which could be frightening in its intensity at times, you know, where was that coming from, and following those breadcrumb trails back to the sort of psychosexual and social dynamics. That was a very early inspiration, like delineating that, you know, early inspiration, and that definitely fed into the character of Toby. I have more to say about the incel angle.
The book is, it's open for interpretation. Some people might interpret it as an alt-right or incel or red pill novel, but at the same time, it could also be interpreted as a book that's a condemnation of radical or of violence, or kind of a book like a cautionary tale against the process where someone becomes radicalized. So it is open for interpretation, but also there's actually no talk of how incels should lift themselves up from their bootstraps in the book, which you get both from the mainstream and also from a lot of the kind of red pill types. So that's not a theme, but rather the take is mm-hmm. that if we don't fix the brokenness of societies and better ways to direct energies, then that is what leads to tragedies and violence. But I'd say overall it is open to interpretation. There's no like clear narrative of what is the right what's morally right, or what is the right political position. It's mm-hmm. it's basically just telling a story, and different people in the readership can have their own take on it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I hope it was successfully open to interpretation. That's what I was trying to get at earlier, where it's definitely a political novel because the themes are very political, but I really hope that it doesn't read like a, like it has an agenda or like it's a polemic. It really is meant to, it's political, you know, autobiography to an extent. It delineates, a process of different thinking, and there's different characters and different events in the story, which represent different, very different ideas. And, you know, I think the novel sort of has, you know, as many novels might, you know, it sort of has a moderate bent to it, where it's like, okay, let's consider these things calmly. Let's not take any rash action. I think the novel, you know, tilts you a little bit towards a sort of center, more moderate position. But at the same time, I tried to, you know, be very, you know, I was very unguarded, uncensored in explorations of much more extreme points of view, as represented by, you know, the fascistic Wallingford character and his influence on Toby.
Oh, yeah, it's interesting because Wallingford, he kind of, this scene in the book seems like he's a bit manipulative, but when he starts grooming Toby, Professor Wallingford, he does talk about like the social mechanisms of Yellow House and society as a whole, and he does talk about how different personality types We'll Rise Up, and how Toby, like, your talents are not going to be a knowledge because of your demeanor. And that's obviously manipulative, but he does, like, his observations about, like, social mechanisms of society.
He's not necessarily wrong. Or even if he's manipulating Toby towards an end which Toby maybe wouldn't choose in his right mind, you know, Wallingford is supposed to have picked up on a need and desires within Toby. This is the whole story, really. This is the whole point. Wallingford, he's the villain of the book, for all intents and purposes. But the point is, he located desires and needs within Toby that were not being met by a society, you know, by society at large and by his college campus, and was able to utilize those. And I would say that's a major theme within the book and where it becomes open for interpretation.
Do you think erotic energy is challenged into other endeavors, both creative and harmful behavior?
Yeah, no, that theme touches on what we were talking about a moment ago. The idea is that, you know, there's that one has a certain amount of erotic energy, so to speak, and that can be channeled both towards creative or destructive ends. In the case of Wallingford, he locates that within Toby, you know, the sort of desires and erotic energies that Toby couldn't find a more normative place for, and ends up directing them toward violence.
Yeah, also with the incel angle, the character Zoe, she's basically just his crush, and she basically kind of tells him, kind of politely tells him off that she wants nothing to do with, that she doesn't want anything to do with him, or yeah. Just to keep, kind of keep, like, gatekeeping that, just to keep the relationship as acquaintances, and that she has no interest in him. And, so yeah, she's just purely a crush, but originally, did you have it so that she broke up with him? And I think you sent me one of your original drafts that portrayed Zoe pressuring Toby into oral intimacies, but the thing is that doesn't, confused things, because you wanted to show that he had a low social status. So yeah, Zoe's mostly just his crush, so can you comment on his relationship with Zoe, and also what is his status in the hierarchy? Is he supposed to be like, this one we're gonna call like a trousseau, or just someone more? You also say he's like decent looking, but kind of a pretty boy, but very shy and timid. So kind of explaining, like, how would you describe Toby's social status, and then also his psychological profile and his relationship with Zoe?
Yeah, no, I toyed with them having had more of a previous relationship, and then, I mean, even still, they sort of went out for a time in Toby's first semester of college, and the book is set in his second, and I toyed with them, you know, having actually had sex and things like that, and then it became more apparent that, and I don't think I state this in the book explicitly, but that Toby would be a more virginal character. And this is how I'd put it. I don't really see him as a true trousseau or even like a delta male. Not that I'm even fully familiar with some of the full definitions of these terms. I see him more as, you said it, you know, shy and sort of maladjusted and really very young. He's only supposed to be 19. So I view him more, you know, he's not unattractive. He's just kind of a very normal, average, sort of beta-type male, more so. And in as far, you know, he's no trousseau, but in as far as he's struggled sexually and romantically, I think it has
clear, like, she's way above his league, looks and status-wise?
Not necessarily. I would say that she's,
she's actually not supposed to be, like, the most attractive popular girl in this school.
Well, I mean, I don't know if those terms of popularity apply as well in college. I mean, she's supposed to be very good looking, maybe a bit better looking than Toby, but Toby's not supposed to be bad looking. I think the difference between them has less to do with looks as, well, you said status. I think she's just way more confident than him. She knows more what she wants, and she's kind of in this more slightly more feminist influenced paradigm where she
wants... yeah, like the whole thing about her her college experience is for her as an individual to explore that kind of thinking.
Exactly. I mean, this isn't quite a narrative of like some guy. You know, Toby becomes a little bit stalkerish with Zoe in the beginning, but not really. He's not someone who sees someone from afar and thinks they're meant to be. He's someone, he met her in a film class. They spent some time together. Maybe they even kissed, but they didn't, go all the way, so to speak. And, maybe Toby's never done that before, and he really liked her, and he maybe thought they would get married or something. He fell hard, as a lot of naive younger men do, and that was just never what Zoe wanted, I guess. And yeah, as we noted, is much more influenced by that sort of more feminist paradigm, and kind of tells him she doesn't tell him off too harshly. She just says, "Look, I don't really like you like that, and for me, college is about dating a lot of people." And she kind of sends him on his way, but it's not quite. And I don't mean
also, His psychological profile, he doesn't come across as the way like Elliot Rodger did in his manifesto. He does, for the first half of the book, he comes across as at least somewhat like level-headed.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, there's a when Toby does end up in a much darker place, I think it's pretty explicit that
there's a bunch of like smaller turning points. But when he confronts the guy who's with Zoe, like, that's one of the big ones.
Yeah, I mean, this is the influence mostly of Wallingford on Toby. Again, not to get into dissecting the plot or...
Wallingford, he kind of encourages him, like, don't accept your place. Like, you're better than the status, the role that society gives you. You need to demand, like, more because you really are great. You really are brilliant. And then that makes him more... That brings out the aggression in him.
Yeah, and there's a whole that does perhaps that's intellectually what happens, and then there's darker currents too. Wallingford is supposed to be someone enmeshed in the occult, and does he have some sort of almost supernatural or occultic influence on Toby? I think that is certainly laid out as a possibility by the novel. But yeah, you're right. The psychological profile. Sorry about that. The psychological profile is not quite. It's not quite Elliot Rodger. It's more, this could be anyone, and then a very dark path is laid before him by an external source that took something that was there, which was not a full-on mentally ill personality, but a very fragile personality, perhaps a weak personality.
So Wallingford, you'd say he's an embodiment or influence of some of the most, you'd say, the more kind of pagan, agnostic aspects of the alt-right, so kind of a broad influences, you'd say, and then also like homo nationalism, and your earlier essays about on homo nationalism. If you want to just kind of comment, so Wallingford, he's not based on one particular person, but broadly, kind of influenced. What is he kind of broadly influenced by?
Yeah, no, I don't really want to name drop anyone per se, but later as I was writing the novel, I wanted to, that it became evident that Wallingford embodied not just the dissident right or the alt-right as a whole,
like a Faustian, tapping into like a Faustian energy.
Yeah, what I perceived as the more demonic, more decadent elements of the alt-right. Definitely the more pagan end of things, as opposed to the more Christian or secular end of things. He represents Wallingford represents accelerationism, an embrace of chaos, and just a much more demonic take on what should be done to save the West. In contrast with with the more sort of more left-hand path or Gnostic sense about, what should be done. So, another, and again, I'm not trying to name drop anyone, but also in line with someone like Jason Giorgiani, who we've had on the show recently, that style of thinking, broad overhaul.
Like the theme on like past shows from several years ago, like more aristocratic radicalism rather than conservatism?
Definitely more aristocratic radicalism than conservatism, and also aristocratic radicalism with emphasis on the radicalism.
How would you define that term even?
Aristocratic radicalism?
Do you even go into that theme? Like, how would you define aristocratic radicalism?
I mean, in general, I don't really go into it in the novel, but I would, in general, I think aristocratic radicalism, for lack of a better way of describing it, is pretty much the upshot of a lot of Nietzsche's views.
Like, I think Nietzsche or even Oscar Wilde, like those figures get mentioned.
Yes, in terms of aristocratic radicalism. I don't think Oscar Wilde is referenced in the book, but he's certainly referenced in my old homo nationalism blog posts. And Crowley and Nietzsche are very explicitly referenced as influences on Wallingford. Wallingford definitely represents that view of aristocratic radicalism having to do with... This taps into, short of a great definition of aristocratic radicalism in general, it taps into the notion of elite replacement theory, which you explore in some of your work.
Yeah, that's a big...
Notion of not simply being against the current elites because they're degenerate.
Replacement theory or counter-elitism, it's basically, I don't know if you'd say anti-populist or just different than populism, but it's also... rejecting the idea that the only way to rise to the top is through the current hierarchy. But then it also could portray in a negative, it also portrays that idea because I think subconsciously that idea of like being the natural elite maybe goes to Toby so much that some might interpret it as driving him towards extremism, which some more kind of liberal or normie conservative types would interpret it that way. But that, yeah, like the idea that you're the natural elite and you're being deprived of your place in the hierarchy, that's a major theme.
Yeah, certainly. And I know that's a theme in your work as well, Robert. Your fiction. That taps into something to do with aristocratic radicalism. Yeah, this notion of... And it also even taps into the accelerationist theme I was talking about, which I would say Wallingford very explicitly is an accelerationist of, you know, we can't rise through the ranks and change things that way. We can't inject, you know, ourselves into the current order in order to affect the change we want. And rather, we need to burn everything down and replace it with something new. Because we are the true elites and we have to, you know, cut the heads off the elites that exist. I mean, I think that gets to the heart of a lot of what Wallingford disposes and a lot of what he, sort of teaches to Toby. And, It does get to a divide within the dissident right, as you said, because, I mean, it's kind of hard to find people who very explicitly say that. I mean, Jason Giorgiani might be one example.
Jason Giorgiani, on the last show I did, he said he's radically anti-populist.
Yeah, well, okay, in terms of the relation to populism, I mean, this doesn't...
It's possible with populism, like, the two could complement each other. Like, they don't have to... the question is there an inherent conflict, which there could be, but there doesn't have to be.
Yeah, no, I don't think there has to be. I think that, there's two ways of looking at this. One way is that populism, you know, by would-be tyrants, the counter-elite, one theory would be that they're only as populist as they're willing, you know, and as far as they're populist, they're manipulative because they're simply trying to manipulate the masses to go along with them. That's a negative interpretation.
And yeah, if you look at populism, both Bernie's left-wing populism and Trump's right-wing populism, I think both of those movements ended up being utter failures.
I guess so. I mean, people would say, yeah, and people who despise either of those figures, especially you hear it more so about Trump, they would say...
There's people who despise those figures from a pro-establishment standpoint or pro-mainstream society, like maintaining social society as one cohesive unit. But also if, I guess from a standpoint of elite replacement theory, then you can make a critique why those two movements failed.
Yeah, I mean, I think that some people would say that... someone like Trump, you know, manipulated the masses to try and get his own selfish ends. My view isn't necessarily that. I think that there can be a more natural... I think that aristocratic radicalism and elite replacement... aristocratic radicalism and populism can be much easier bedfellows that in a sense that I'm not an expert theorist on this, but some people would argue that the masses of people would rather have a strong leader, so that the interests of both the interests of the masses and of the would-be elites don't necessarily need to contradict, that meritocratic society is good not only for those who rise up in it, but also for everyone. I'm way more disposed to that view, that populism and aristocratic radicalism can go hand in hand. Now, that's not explicitly in the book. We're diverging somewhat.
But, so with the book, like, the alt-right and, like, white student unions are referenced. So overall, like, race is... It's not a major theme. It's more of a side note. But there is talk of, like, Yellow House, like, Wallenford. He also kind of manipulates him and I think he tells him that he personally is excluded because of affirmative action. And that kind of the personal connection puts him on the path towards where he ends up. And then also there is this depiction where he interacts with some foreign students, kind of like racially ambiguous, who they disrespect him, but then he does have this visceral reaction, like they are stealing his birthright.
Yeah, so once Wallingford has more of an influence on Toby, he becomes much more politically disenfranchised, much angrier, and I guess you could say much more right-wing.
And then also, like, with homo-nationalism, like, you've written about that and about Camille Paglia and male bonding to kind of together to create civilization as a defense against aspects of liberalism, but then also the kind of triumph of, like, of radical creativity, the homosexuals' role in that as a kind of the shamanesque nature of homosexuals rather than liberal gay rights or gay identity. So when we first talked, like, your earlier essays were about homo-nationalism, and even talk in the book, there's, like, homo-nationalists are a kind of meme in the book, but can you kind of explain the significance of that? And then you also have something called literary phallology, if you want to explain that, too.
Well, I always say when I'm talking about this that I'm not gay, but when I wrote this book, I was definitely tapping into the parts of myself that were the most sort of uninfluenced by sort of female influence. So there's my most androphilic aspects, to put it in Jack Donovan type terms, and. There is an element of, an undercurrent of, what we've described on this show in the past, and I used to write about it on, Alt Center, as homo-nationalism, represented by, the Wallingford character, his relationship with Toby, and, some of the other people in his orbit, and... I think that idea has to do with sort of radicalizing elements that Camille Paglia addresses pretty well in Sexual Personae about men sort of bonding together and excluding women as a means of creating and sustaining civilization. And in the context of the radical right-wing politics that Wallingford later comes to embody in the book, that is taken very literally as and very sexually. So that would be the significance of the idea of homo-nationalism in the book. It's also talked about as a meme that people sort of find online, and they're not sure if it's a joke, but it seems to have very real significance within the novel.
And then you also, there mm-hmm. could be this, there's a kind of dialect about human nature and how it relates to sexuality. Like, the example of, like, contrasting the view of human nature of Rousseau with that of Nietzsche or even the Marquis de Sade, that's more the idea that human nature is egalitarian versus a view of human nature that is very ugly, mm-hmm. focused on power, hierarchy, and then...
Well, not necessarily ugly,
with sexuality,
right?
That, like, focuses very much on power dynamics and hierarchy, and then with sexuality... That can be, like, you can you can look at like Aleister Crowley, Do What Thou Wilt, and like the Marquis de Sade, versus like sex positive feminism, which obviously is very different than Dworkin, who ironically, like someone like Andrea Dworkin, she's a radical feminist, but she does understand, she does like have a better understanding of power dynamics. But contracting the kind of idealized liberal view influenced by Rousseau, that human nature is egalitarian, anything that parts from that is like a perversion or a transgression, and that's an influence. And then also, like Foucault's views on sexuality, that's relevant too. But the role that, like, your thoughts on the role that plays.
Yeah. No. Definitely. Definitely, definitely, the book doesn't really have a very Rousseauian take on human sexuality and human nature. Rather, it has a sense about it that's very rooted in power dynamics, and that's also the literary theory that Professor Wallingford espouses.
Wait, so literary phallogy, it sounds pretty silly, but it's the idea that you can guess a man's penis size by reading his literature?
Yeah, that's the idea. And that, when I say satire, obviously that idea is satirical, but it's not too far downstream from stuff that you really do come across.
It's a satire of critical theory.
It's a satire of critical theory, but also, if you've ever read someone like Jacques Lacan, there really are people who are obsessed with the phallus as a psychological signifier and the relation between that and writing. I mean, this stuff is actually hits pretty close to home if you delve into, thinkers like Jacques Lacan, Derrida, to an extent Foucault. These people really, there's the thing they tell you, maybe it's more of a high school English thing to say, and maybe it's a joke, but people say, everything in literature signifies sex, except for sex, which signifies power. That's something that...
Is that Paglia?
That's kind of surround. And that a lot of English professors really do teach
literature. Isn't that a Paglia quote?
I don't think it is a Paglia quote. Definitely, she might be someone who would agree with it to some extent. I don't know who said that originally, but it's something that I heard early on in college, and I found it to be reductive, but also maybe that there was a truth to that. And that's sort of the type of teaching, the type of pedagogy I was parodying with literary philology. But, if you follow that rabbit hole down, that view of sexuality, boiling down to power dynamics, well, you can have a left-wing take on that. You can be, more Foucaultian, or you can have a sort of more Marxist-tinged take where it's like, the reality is based in these power dynamics, and we have to overcome them, overcome the contradictions, and find more of a, a more of a harmony. You can
actually, a lot of leftist, economic leftists, and then also radical feminists like Dworkin acknowledge the role of power dynamics, and then the right wing does too. So, but it seems like there's these people in the middle who deny it. It's the people in the kind of in the in between who deny or ignore it.
Yeah, no. There's that's an interesting point, and that's definitely one of the things I was hoping to get at with the whole sort of connection between this, not horseshoe theory, but the connection between far left and far right theory that have to do with these power dialectics that are rooted in viewing reality as struggle. People on both the far left and far right are more likely to view reality and life as struggle, right? And a lot of people in the middle kind of want to gloss over that and say, they sort of revel in the middle class normalcy of it all. But on the, both in far, quote unquote, far left critical theory and also in right wing views, again, maybe the German connection a bit. There's this understanding of dialectics rooted in Hegel, explored, in different ways by Nietzsche and Heidegger, which has a take that, these jockeying for power and jockeying for status actually has a huge influence. And needless to say, it's well-founded in Freud and psychoanalysis as well, this view that that jockeying for status has a considerable influence over our day-to-day life. That's something that I charted both as being, more found among thinkers of the left and the right. Certainly someone like Julius Evola also, is influenced by some of these ideas. And that is what the character of Wallingford and his ideas come to embody, is the connection between those and how he can take, he can preach, life as struggle from a left-wing perspective, and then take a certain number of students he deems elite under his wing and say, well, actually, life is struggle, but, you know, the goal is to be, is to come out on top, so to speak, just simply saying, you know, these critiques of power dynamics that the left engages in, they're real, but why should our goal be oriented towards egalitarianism and equality? That's kind of what lays down further the rabbit hole in the book, and where Toby ultimately ushers, where Wallingford ultimately ushers Toby is toward a radically inegalitarian take on some of the same power dynamics explored in the exoterically left-wing critical theory he engages in.
And is there anything else you want to add about Dragon Day, and do you have any other upcoming projects that you're working on?
What I'd add, just to kind of sum up our conversation a bit here, is that yes, the novel is open for interpretation, as we highlighted. The main narrator, Charles, is kind of an observer of everything that happens to the protagonist, Toby, and parts of it are written from a close, parts of it are written from the first person's perspective, that is Charles, and parts of it are written from a close third on Toby. And, you know, the point of view that Charles ultimately comes away with, again, I don't want to call it neocon or IDW or anything like that, but it's a sort of someone moving from a more normie centrist view to some alternative kind of view, which isn't made very explicit in the book, but, you know, his worldview is certainly evolving even as the novel ends. That's one point of view, and then there's also the point of view that comes across from the Wallingford character, who, as we highlighted, is fairly aristocratic, fairly much an aristocratic radical, and espouses a much more pagan, decadent form of accelerationism. I think the novel ultimately leaves it up for interpretation, whether you're more sympathetic to the kind of above-board, level-headed, sort of conservative-type views that Charles ultimately comes to, or whether you're more inclined towards the sort of Faustian deal with the devil kind of thinking embodied by Wallingford. I think it's open for interpretation in as far as that goes. And also, to highlight a theme from earlier, we talked about how there's a theme of, you know, what do you do with your energy? You know, what happens when society doesn't make room for that energy? And I would say that that's my take on the whole incel angle we discussed. You know,
even beyond the incel angle, just if society fails to give someone a role, and then especially, like, it's especially worse if that person has immense talents, or just fairly intelligent. It's even worse. I mean, ideally, everyone should be given some kind of role.
Yeah, certainly everyone should be given some kind of role, and, you talked about, on one level, the novel could be read, this is also how it's open for interpretation, on one level, the novel could be read as a cautionary tale of, you know, what happens when people are radicalized, and it's not pro-violence in any kind of way. However, my take on what leads to that kind of violence is pretty different than you'd get from a mainstream source about the dangers of, white men online or something. Rather, it highlights the degree to which the brokenness of society can lead to individuals who, you know, high IQ, talented individuals with nowhere else to put their energy, nothing else to apply themselves to, you know, may end up going for some of these more accelerationist, destructive ends. So in that sense, well, it is open for, you know, the violence isn't open for interpretation as far as the novel's not pro-violence. But certainly the take on violence, I think, is open for interpretation. And in terms of what I'm working on now, I've got a few different projects on the pipeline.
You're not, like, the blog, the Alt of Center blog. That's kind of that's just kind of an archive for older sites. You're mostly on Substack now.
Yeah, mostly on Substack. I have a couple different kinds of posts I'm working on, and just kind of trying to throw as many pieces of spaghetti against the wall and see what sticks in terms of you know, what the future of my writing online will be.
Matt Pegas, great show. Check out Dragon Day on Terror House Publishing.
Thanks so much, Robert.